on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Hello and good afternoon to you. I'm Sophie Johnson and it's great to have you on the program this Monday. We'll kick off the Country Hour by spending a bit of time talking about the state government's release of the energy roadmap. But later, you've heard of a muster dog, but how about a muster cat? That story just before the weather. Energy Minister David Jenetski on Friday unveiled the state's new energy roadmap, placing coal and gas at its centre while leaving room for renewables such as wind, solar and pumped hydro. The plan extends the life of coal-fired power stations to 2046 and expands gas generation, including a proposed new plant in central Queensland between the Queensland Investment Corporation and the private sector. Queensland Farmers Federation CEO Joe Shepherd is welcoming the release of the roadmap.
We were really pleased to see the roadmap handed down. There has, I guess, been a period of uncertainty over the last sort of, 10 to 12 months. So it's really good now to have clarity about where we are heading and how we are moving forward. The general feedback has been pretty positive in that there is a lot of support, for the balanced and pragmatic approach the Queensland government is taking. There's clear acknowledgement in the plan, in the roadmap, that if we are going to ensure that we have access to reliable, affordable and sustainable energy in the future, then we are going to have to take an integrated approach. Queensland, as we know, is in a really unique position with an abundance of wind, sun, gas and coal. And we need to be working to develop an integrated approach, utilising our natural assets so that we can meet the energy needs in an affordable, sustainable way for all Queenslanders moving forward. And I think, the feedback that I'm receiving is that the roadmap, the pragmatic approach and the balanced approach is giving people confidence in that regard.
Yeah, and what will this roadmap mean for farming enterprises?
So farming enterprises and agriculture more broadly were, waiting for the roadmap to be announced. Energy obviously remains a really key line item for most farmers. QFF have been working deeply in the energy space on behalf of our peak body members for over a decade. Farmers are relatively agnostic when it comes to the source of energy for their enterprises, but are really seeking confidence, that our energy system is actually going to be able to meet their needs into the future. At the launch of the roadmap, the Treasurer did acknowledge that further work is needed to be done in relation to tariff reforms, distributed energy, virtual power plants, bioenergy moving forward. We were pleased to hear this because we know that there is significant interest from many farmers in Queensland around how these future opportunities might benefit their businesses and communities. So we're keen to continue working with the Queensland Government on those opportunities as it unfolds. I'm pleased to say QFF and our peak body members have been at the table in the development of the roadmap, and it is critical that agriculture continues to be part of all the future work in the energy space moving forward. QFF for many years and remain firmly in the position of, how we can help our peak body members, farmers, make informed decisions. There's obviously, a lot of change taking place and still going to take place in terms of our energy system. And it's really important that farmers and regional communities have all the information they need to make the right decisions for their enterprises. Also, obviously, really important, and QFF will continue to advocate for appropriate legislation and frameworks to safeguard valuable agricultural land and water. Because, really we're trying to get this right, not just for today, but for future generations as well.
What are you hoping this will mean for renewable energy overall?
I think whilst the government has been quite clear around taking the renewable energy targets, removing the renewable energy targets, they have also indicated they remain committed to renewable energy being part of the energy mix moving forward. So I think, renewable energy is one important tool in our toolkit on our journey to reduce emissions, but there are other tools. Farmers in relation to renewable energy have been innovating for many years. We're seeing farmers, integrate solar energy into their farming enterprises. But there's still a lot of work to do around how we can integrate those opportunities for farmers so that they can maximise benefits on farm but also in their community. So I think the Treasurer made it very clear that, you know, whilst they are removing the renewable energy targets per se, they remain committed to renewable energy being part of the energy mix. Agriculture obviously has already contributed so much to emission reductions for Queensland and Australia, but we can contribute more as stewards of large areas of land, but we must set achievable targets and tangible deliverables along the way that not only focus on reducing emissions but contribute to other critical things like food security, like vibrant, you know, futures for regional communities, like broader environmental outcomes, like, you know, profitability in the farm sector. We cannot have one without the other, and it's really important that we take a holistic approach as we move forward, you know, on our journey to a reduced emissions environment.
You used the word balanced before. Can you elaborate a bit more about what you mean by that?
I think when you look at the natural assets in relation to sources of energies that we have in Queensland, it makes absolute sense that, you know, sun and wind play a really vital role, but there is also an ongoing role for gas and coal. So I think the pragmatic approach that the government is taking and, you know, a sensible approach to looking at what natural resources we have, thinking about how we can take an integrated approach to firming up, you know, sources of energy for the good of all Queenslanders, I think gives people confidence. I think, you know, obviously farmers and other businesses and households, consumers are, you know, really seeking an energy system that is going to keep up with the increased demand for energy, but also, you know, point to key things like affordability, like reliability, and of course sustainability as well. So I think, you know, if we're talking about sustainability in any regard, an integrated approach and a holistic view is the way that we are going to actually be able to kick goals in that space as well.
Queensland Farmers Federation CEO Joe Shepherd. Some Queensland communities have welcomed plans to keep coal and gas burning across the state, though some warn a lack of future planning could undermine short-term benefits. The ABC's Dan McRae headed down to Yarraman to get Bradley Froloff's thoughts. He's a fourth-generation cattle farmer and butcher shop owner.
Excitement. Yeah, very pleased. I think it's great for us and for our area, keeping employment going here.
Yeah. Just how big is it for the South Burnett region?
Oh, it's massive for our area. It's been a big part of our whole area for a long, long time now. I can't remember the date when it all started, but I know we've had this butcher shop here for 21 years, and the guy I bought the butcher shop from said that the power station made his business and he survived. He built his home because of it, and it's continued on to this day.
Yeah, and you're obviously expanding what you do in the South Burnett, so how are you feeling about the future of the area?
Oh, look, I'm born and bred here. My kids are fifth generation here. We love the area. We need the employment. There's not lots of employment in the area, so the mine and the power station are big parts of our area to keep employment and keep people in this area and spending a dollar in the communities. And it's important to all of us.
Yeah. You've just opened up this new grill that's on the main road here on the highway through Yarraman. Are you looking to target locals as well as through traffic?
Absolutely. Like, locals are always number one for us, but we also need that through traffic and other people as well. So we're very broad in our target. The travellers, but also our locals as well.
Mm-hmm. Just back to energy for a second. Obviously, a lot of the talk is moving to more of a renewables or a mix in the meantime with a bit of gas as well. Are you happy to hear that coal more broadly is going to be sticking around?
Absolutely. I think we've become a little bit hoodwinked by our politicians about all these renewables. When you look into a lot of them, they're actually not saving us any, saving the planet at all. They're actually sometimes worse than what the coal is. So I think we need to look at the big picture and not just what's been dished up to us all the time.
Yeah. It's also probably worth mentioning nuclear power, because Tarong was put aside as, well, at least from the Nationals there, where they'd like to see a nuclear power plant with the existing lines and that sort of thing there and the water source. Do you have any feelings about that maybe not being a priority for the Queensland government?
I think at the moment. I think coal's the way to go, but I definitely think the nuclear could be something to take over from the coal when its time's finished. Possibly a better option than some of the other options we've been getting bandied around at the moment.
And as a cattle farmer, with your farming hat on, do you have a preferred source of energy? Like, do you see renewable as a bit kinder to grazing land?
No, I don't see it as being any kinder whatsoever. A lot of these wind towers that are being put up are quite detrimental to the land. I'm quite happy with the coal power station being next door to us. It's been there since I've been a kid. Creates no problems whatsoever. I think some of these other options that are being chucked up at us, the big solar farms dumped all over your paddocks, wind farms in your paddocks, a lot of noise pollution. There's a lot of issues with some of the others, probably more so than the coal, I believe.
And do you feel like you get that certainty from the coal-fired power station? Because as you say, it's been there for so long now. You know what it is, you know how it runs.
Absolutely. And I think once we lose it, and people start running out of power and our power bills go up, we're all going to start hurting. So I think we need to have a good think about it right now.
The Queensland Renewable Energy Council has also welcomed the release of the Queensland Government's Energy Roadmap, describing it as a pragmatic and an important milestone in delivering a cleaner, more secure and affordable energy future for the state. QREC Chief Executive Officer Katie Ann Mulder said the roadmap strikes a sensible balance between maintaining reliability and creating the conditions for large-scale renewable investment. She said despite the decision to remove renewable energy targets, the roadmap relies on up to 6.8 gigawatts of new wind and solar and 3.8 gigawatts of storage by 2030. This is a pivotal step forward for Queensland. The roadmap keeps the lights on today while accelerating the renewables, storage and transmission needed for tomorrow. Those are some comments from the Queensland Renewable Energy Council CEO, Katie Ann Mulder. During the announcement on Friday, Energy Minister David Janetsky said the government will deliver the Copper String project in the state's north. The planned 1,100 kilometres of powerline network from Townsville to Mount Isa is expected to connect towns and mines to the national electricity market for the first time. Here's what he said.
Today, we released the QIC Copper String Review. The review affirms the government's decision to commence work on the Eastern Link first to connect Hughenden to Townsville to connect to the national electricity market sooner. The Eastern Link will be completed as previously planned by 2032, subject to federal approvals. QIC estimates the Eastern Link alone could unlock up to $10 billion in renewables investments. On-the-ground work is already underway at Hughenden, with further work in the pipeline pending federal approvals, and Powerlink's work camp is readying to welcome staff as development expands. QIC identified the proposed 500 kV specification, arbitrarily expanded by the former government, was not necessary until at least 2050, and that a rescoped 330 kV, together with spur lines and connection savings, could deliver cost reductions of $2.1 billion. Now, turning our attention to the Western Link, and the Northwest has made significant news again this week. That is the Western Link that runs from Hughenden to Mount Isa. The Northwest Minerals Province has 14 existing and up to 55 proposed mines. Demand from these mines, while still uncertain as now, could reach approximately 662 meg by 2040 in a high-growth scenario, with half of this projected increase in demand arising from potential greenfield mining projects. To underpin our government support of the Western Link and the Northwest, I announced today a $200 million Northwest Energy Fund that will support local generation and storage solutions in partnership with the private sector, including to improve energy reliability from Hughenden to Richmond, Julia Creek, Cloncurry and Mount Isa. This fund, together with the local generation and storage solutions approach, will ensure financial decisions can be made by resources companies, knowing there is a reliable and affordable energy solution available before Copper String is completed, bring forward lower energy prices in the Northwest faster than the previous Copper String plan, promote more than $1 billion of private investment in battery storage and renewables in the Northwest, and increase competition across the region.
State Energy Minister David Janetsky. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Sophie Johnson and it is 20 minutes past 12.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. We're here to inform you as to what's happening with local news and events. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Next, an unlikely influencer has risen in the outback. You'll meet Mango the Muster Cat soon. But for now, while we're speaking of emissions, farmers, like every other business, are being encouraged to reduce them. And most of the emissions from the grain sector come from fuel use and fertilisers. It turns out that about half of the nitrous oxide getting into the atmosphere from fertilisers could be cut by just switching to enhanced or coated products. David Claughton filed this report.
Farmers use fertilisers to promote growth in crops and pastures, but about half of it can be lost because it leaches into the water table or expires into the air. And that's a big problem for global warming.
Nitrous oxide is an extremely damaging greenhouse gas. Its effect on the atmosphere is nearly 300 times a molecule of carbon dioxide. And that's why we are trying to reduce it through any means possible.
Peter Grace is a professor of global change at the Queensland University of Technology. He helped write an industry white paper on ways to reduce emissions from the grain sector. One solution is to coat fertilisers like urea and ammonium nitrate to slow down the release of nitrogen to the plants.
The use of fertiliser obviously is essential in many cropping systems and even pastures. We apply various fertilisers, urea, UAN, urea, ammonium nitrate, etc. But what we're trying to do with enhanced efficiency fertilisers is basically slow the availability of that nitrogen for the plant to take it up. If it all becomes available when you apply it, there's a greater potential for losses of that fertiliser, and that's an economic loss and an environmental loss.
Well, the concern there is that it might leach into the groundwater or it might be expired into the air in some way. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Leaching is an issue more so in the western parts of the country, the lighter textured soils, sandy soils. This side of the country, eastern, clay soils in a lot of places where you'll get denitrification happening, and that's where you get significant losses. The Midwest US, huge amounts of leaching into groundwater, which has become a major issue in that country for the last 30, 40 years.
So why isn't the take-up of coated fertilisers more advanced in Australia? Like, what would be the rate, do you reckon, of people that are using coated fertilisers?
I would have to say maybe 5%. That might be even an overestimate. The reason why is it costs too much and it's not being demonstrated that if you put that on, you're getting the same yield as you would if you use regular fertilisers like urea, UAN, other nitrogen fertilisers. So that yield boost, which is what the farmer really wants to see, is not being demonstrated.
According to Peter Grace, studies show there's just one fertiliser on the market that is effective in consistently reducing emissions. But if all farmers switch to an effective coated fertiliser, it could cut emissions from the grain sector by 50%. Assuming that reliability issue can be resolved, how can the federal government improve the take-up? Well, the cost is about 20% more, so some mechanism may be needed to bring the cost down to make it worthwhile. Researchers have looked at establishing a methodology that would give farmers or manufacturers a carbon credit for using them. Stephen Annells is the executive manager of Fertiliser Australia, the group representing manufacturers. He's hoping the government will support one of those ideas.
We had a number of suggestions to the government in the white paper, and one of those was to use Australian carbon credit units, ACCUs, to offset the cost of the inhibitors. And so that would then reduce that cost for growers. There is a big risk that something called carbon leakage would occur, which is where an organisation would choose to either move their production offshore to jurisdictions that have lower mandates, or just to close up altogether and to import the product. That causes that risk. But within the fertiliser industry, the manufacturing has been declining for many, many years, not just because of the safeguard mechanism, but because of other factors like industrial relations, environmental laws, and also gas prices and energy prices within Australia are prohibitive as well. So the next step in that safeguard mechanism and the carbon leakage is an offset called the border carbon adjustment. And that's been applied in Europe. At the moment, that's sitting at somewhere around about €70 per tonne, so that's quite scary.
Stephen Annells from Fertiliser Australia. And there's one other reason why he says farmers might be swayed to increase the use of inhibitors or coated fertilisers. He says they can increase the shelf life of a product, which could lead to less waste.
David Claughton with that report on how coated fertilisers could cut emissions from the grain sector by 50%. 26 minutes past 12 on the Country Hour. I'm Sophie Johnson.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Deep in the Mulga lands of Western Queensland, an unlikely influencer has risen. Move over, Muster Dogs, there's a new cat in town. Having been raised alongside working dogs, Mango isn't your average feline. Hannah Walsh has the story.
Wait, is that a cat on a motorbike?
He comes on the bike with the dogs, he gets tied in the back of the car with the dogs, he's been mustering, he helps down in the yards, drafting and working wieners, so he just thinks he's a dog, except he's got the attitude of a cat.
Meet Mango, the Mulga Muster Cat. The whiskered, four-legged influencer of the outback comes complete with his own Facebook page, loyal followers, and even fan mail.
Definitely has all these older ladies wrapped around his paw, that's for sure. He's received jackets and little hats and little croc boots, and one lady even made him special cat biscuit treats.
Tied onto the back of a ute alongside five working dogs, Mango almost blends in.
So he was raised with pups.
Until you realise he's a cat and you really do a double take.
And it's a bit different, like, you know, on properties people have working dogs and stuff like that, but not too many people have cats.
Mango's rise to fame, like many social media stars, almost happened by accident.
Beck, is that a cat on the bike with you? I went, oh yeah, that's Mango. Like, I didn't even think twice.
Beck had sent videos to a friend surveying flood damage around her property earlier this year.
So she's like, let's do a Facebook page for Mango and he can be the mascot for Western Queensland with the floods. Let people know what, like, where we're at and how things are going now with the recovery from the flood. And it just, you know, puts a bit of a brightness on the dark side of life.
Beck Smith lives on and runs a 53,000-hectare station near Stonehenge, a tiny town about 90 minutes from Longreach. During destructive flooding earlier this year, she estimates about 70% of her property went underwater. And it's been a domino effect since, not being able to muster or sell cattle. The bills are piling up.
Just wiped out, like, whole, like, you know, kilometres and kilometres and kilometres and sections of fence. And it was very, very daunting at the start when you could slowly go around and see firsthand just the damage that was left behind.
Rebuilding fencing and purchasing the materials to do so has put Beck back at least $100,000.
And I try not to think about that dollar figure too much, because if you do, it does become very overwhelming. Like, I know you've got to have it in the back of your mind, but yeah, you try not to focus on it too much because it is very daunting.
And it's money that must be spent up front before she can be reimbursed through government grants.
And that's the issue. Most people don't have that money sitting there to go and purchase the fencing materials.
So filming videos of Mango being one of the dogs, chasing cows or taking a ride on the motorbike, helps Beck open up about life on the land after disaster.
Mango, tie you on. No, I don't need to tie you big dogs on, but I need to tie him on. Move your foot. people looking at him and laughing at his antics, but then they're also seeing, you know, what we're going through as well.
Because she says talking about mental health can still be really hard in the bush.
And I used to be very, very embarrassed by my mental health journey, and then I just got to the point where it's part of my healing process to speak about it. And, you know, if even one person can relate to me and have enough confidence then to put their hand up for help, you know, I've paid it forward. People on the land don't like to be seen as having any weaknesses, because you've got to be tough. You've got to be able to handle everything that life throws at you.
Which she says is even more apparent if you're a woman.
There's a lot more, you know, there's more women working in the ag industry now, but it's still very much a man's playground. So whatever a man does, you have to do it twice as hard and tougher than what they do. And it is hard on that front, that if you start looking a bit too soft, oh, well, you're a woman, get out of a man's game type thing. And you do still cop that a little bit, but I suppose I'm older, so it doesn't worry me as much.
And life on the land is second nature to Beck. With Mango by her side, the duo are rebuilding and not letting the world forget what happened.
Having him there, it takes the harshness away of talking about, like, the devastation. Because I know if I just was putting up posts about, like, washed away fences and dead stock and stuff, people sort of just switch off to it. They get a bit, you know, desensitised to it all. But then when you throw in a lovely little fluffy cat and you know, he's got so much personality, he definitely has so much personality, and it just draws people in.
Here, go back.
That's Beck Smith finishing that report from Hannah Walsh. It is 31 minutes past 12 on the country hour. Time to go check in with the Weather Bureau, and we have Harry Clark on duty today. Good afternoon, Harry. Oh, lost Harry, have we? We'll see if we can find him. Hello, Harry, can you hear me?
Yes, good afternoon.
There he is. So, Harry, we'll start with fire conditions. How are they looking today?
Yeah, generally we have seen our fire danger ratings ease back to moderate for most districts, other than the northwest where they are still high. So today, really, a fair bit of moisture across the state thanks to some easterly winds, and a good chance of seeing some showers and thunderstorms for most areas.
Yeah, and what can we expect there over the coming days?
Yeah, I guess reflecting on the last 24 hours, we saw broad thunderstorms stretching all the way from the northwest down into the sort of central and southern interior, and even into the upper Burnett, and some decent falls of that, up to sort of 40 millimetres or so, places like Kingaroy, Taroom. Even into the northwest, we saw a couple of isolated falls up around 30 millimetres. Today, broadly similar conditions expected. So afternoon showers and thunderstorms expected all the way from the northwest down into the southeast corner of the state, and also up into the Gulf Country and Peninsula as well. Generally, probably less rain in terms of totals today than yesterday. And really the only chance of severity will be largely confined to southeastern Queensland today. For other parts along the coast, so central Queensland coast and north Queensland coast, just partly cloudy conditions today. And on the temperature front, we are seeing generally cooler conditions today with that increase in moisture than we have for much of the last week.
Yeah, and is there going to be much more rain to come throughout the week?
Yeah, tomorrow we do see continued showers and thunderstorms right across the interior of the state, except for the far southwest. And with those, particularly storms north of Longreach, we'll have a little bit of tropical moisture to work with. So while not everywhere we'll manage to get underneath one of those showers and thunderstorms, areas that do in the afternoon tomorrow do have a chance of picking up some decent totals, even sort of 30, 40 millimetres in isolated places. So that includes places sort of like Longreach, Mount Isa and the Gulf Country, and much of the peninsula as well. We will see showers and thunderstorms tomorrow afternoon extend into parts of the sort of upper Burnett, the central highlands and coalfields as well, even inland parts of the central coast and Capricornia, but will be a lot more hit and miss in those locations. So continued unstable weather across the interior of the state. In the east, relatively settled along the coastline, other than some increasing showers about the far north Queensland coast tomorrow. So a bit of a tropical wave or tropical surge of moisture coming in to our coastline north around Ingham tomorrow, and that will increase shower activity for those areas. Potentially some isolated falls in excess of 50 millimetres, most likely around those usual wet spots, the Cassowary coast, the Daintree and northern parts of the peninsula.
Let's talk temperatures now. There was that heatwave warning for the north over the weekend. What happened there?
Yeah, we've seen really persistently above average temperatures be a feature of our October weather really over the last fortnight. And generally, we still do see above average temperatures across the state, typically sort of 2 to 4 degrees above average right throughout today. But we are finally seeing that heat lose its grip as we do see an increased easterly flow develop, particularly from tomorrow onwards. So generally, temperatures will be close to the October average from Tuesday. So for inland locations, that's typically the mid-30s up to the high 30s in the northwest and Gulf Country, and along the east coast around 30 degrees. So really not too much change in the short term, those same sort of temperatures expected as we head throughout the week. But as we get towards Friday, ahead of our next trough system, we do see those temperatures once again starting to increase, particularly in the southwest. So temperatures in the southwest by Friday, up around that sort of, even 8 degrees above average mark, and that heat will then slowly spread eastwards into much of the remainder of the state over the weekend. So I guess a brief reprieve from the heat for most locations in the short term, but another round on the way later in the week and over the weekend.
Yeah, and what are those top temperatures today?
Today, starting in the northwest, we have Mount Isa going for around 37 degrees, Birdsville going for 35, Longreach going for 36, heading further south, Charleville 32, Toowoomba up to 28 degrees today, Gympie going for 31, and in central Queensland we've got Rocky going for 34 degrees, Emerald up to 33, and then further north, Charters Towers 35 degrees, Townsville 31, and in the far north, Mareeba heading for 32 degrees today.
And what's happening with the winds?
Yeah, we haven't got too much wind around the state at the moment. We do have generally on our coastal waters east to northeasterly winds 10 to 15 knots for most locations, tending a bit more north-northeasterly for central and southern Queensland today. As we head into tomorrow, we do start to see our ridge of high pressure strengthen, and that typically means those winds will be reaching up to 20 knots for most locations from tomorrow from the east or southeast, and then we do have the potential for some strong wind warnings for the far north Queensland waters, mainly north of Cairns from Wednesday as that ridge continues to strengthen. So that ridge building over the next few days on our coastal waters and increasing the winds and also pushing our thunderstorm risk further inland as we get towards the end of the week.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Harry.
Thanks very much.
And a reminder that local fire bans are in place for 12 council areas across parts of northern and central Queensland today. During fire bans, you are not allowed to light any fires in the open, but some exceptions do apply, including for power tools, lawn mowers and essential and agricultural purposes. The full list of council areas with bans in place and more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban are available on the Queensland Fire Department website at fire.qld.gov.au. It is 23 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. You're with me, Sophie Johnson.
Where do you take the ABC Listen app?
On the bus.
Walking the dog. Pookie.
On my bike.
Take ABC Local Radio with you wherever you go with the ABC Listen app.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Australian gold is on track to become the second largest export earner for the national economy. That's according to the Minerals Council of Australia, after government figures forecast export earnings to reach $60 billion for the current financial year. David Parker from the council says the growth over the last year has been unprecedented.
I think if you look at the circumstances, we're a reliable supplier of gold. We've been doing it in Australia, and particularly Western Australia, for a long time. In fact, since the 1890s and a bit before that. And we are globally recognised as a reliable and dependable supplier of gold into these growing gold global markets. I think the other part too, as we discussed earlier on, really the flow on of this surge of gold activity hopefully starts to see, a real spike in on-ground exploration and investment for gold and copper gold type projects. And we are seeing a lot of activity in some of the frontier areas of the state, like the Paterson-Roodle province up in the remote East Pilbara of Western Australia, where suddenly the market is really getting behind a number of these exploration plays and, trying to look for new sources of a product which can supply a insatiable demand. But, I think we can now rightly be recognised, the industry can now rightly be recognised as a cornerstone of Australia's economic power and resilience.
And you talk about that global demand and looking year on year at those export earnings, I mean, up 42% for 24-25 and then forecast to go up another 28% for the current financial year. I mean, that's astronomic.
It is, it is. And that's what really places the sector as Australia's second largest export earner after iron ore. And we've seen the benefits of what iron ore revenues have done to federal and state budgets and the flow-on benefits which have come from the Australian economy from iron ore. So, you know, this is a very significant market development and one hopefully is widely recognised across Australia.
You say second after iron ore, David. I mean, is there any potential that it could surpass iron ore? I mean, at the moment, potentially $60 billion industry next year?
Look, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, iron ore is a very critical industry for Australia and for the Australian economy. It's a bulk commodity and a lot of it is underpinned by long-term industrial activity. Gold is quite responsive to immediate events. When you think of war in Europe, when you think of other geopolitical tensions, it does move very, very quickly. So I think if we're second largest export, I think we're doing very, very well with our gold sector.
David Parker from the Minerals Council of Australia speaking with Tara de Landgraaf. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Sophie Johnson and it is 19 minutes to one.
Need inspiration? It's on ABC iView.
Pushing the boundaries of design.
I come from the culture of storytelling.
I am real excited.
Grand Designs Australia, the Kimberley and the piano. Find them all where it's always free, always inspiring. ABC iView.
This is The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
What could Australia learn from Japan's response to a bird flu outbreak? That's what Chief Executive of Egg Farmers of Australia, Melinda Hashimoto, is hoping to find out. As a recent recipient of a Churchill Fellowship, she'll travel to Japan later this year to look into the country's response to the disease. And with Australia being the last continent to remain free of the deadly H5 variant, she tells Claudia Sullivan she hopes the trip will help prepare our response to any biosecurity threat.
So we've had outbreaks in 2020, 2024 and earlier this year, and they've been varying strains, you know, H7 strains, but the H5 strain is like a contagious virus. It's more contagious than the others and it can move, you know, from wild birds into our poultry. It also moves into other mammals and then it can move to humans. So that's why it's just really important that we prepare the best that we can. And I think that given that other countries have had H5, we can learn a lot to be able to then transfer that into what we're doing here to protect Australians.
Yeah, so what might be some of the consequences to an outbreak as well? What happens in Japan? How do they manage an outbreak?
Yeah, well, certainly in Japan, they have differing kind of parameters within their framework. So similarly in Australia where we have, floods or droughts and the army comes in to help, they also have, you know, their defence come in to help with avian influenza outbreaks. So they've got different settings to us. And I think also their structures, to support farmers are a little bit different to what we have here in Australia. So I'm keen to learn about that. And there's new discussion all the time. At the moment, there's worldwide a discussion around using vaccination to safeguard our poultry flocks, and that's an area that I'll be looking into.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of different ramifications there in terms of the cost of an outbreak and how many birds might have to be put down as well, and I guess protecting human life, human health. It sounds like a very, very important thing what you're doing. Are you excited to go over to Japan to look into it all?
I am, because I think we realise now that it's agriculture, you know, environment and health is all linked in together. So no longer do we have the silos that we used to have. We're all working quite closely on a global scale, but I'm keen to understand how their departments work together. Also, I'm meeting with the Japan Poultry Association, which is my counterpart in Japan. I'm quite excited to see them and understand how industry feeds into that work with government, just as we do here.
Yeah, and I guess can you tell me about your role here as well? What day is it today?
Well, today is an exciting day. It's World Egg Day, 10th of October. So thank you to everyone that's been, you know, supporting our egg farmers and having eggs, you know, across the day today. Yeah, you're wearing some egg earrings to celebrate. Have you had an egg at all as well? Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I think everyone's got their favourite style of how they like their eggs. Mine are boiled eggs. They're my favourite. But I think all of us have, you know, eggs in the refrigerator, and they're used in so many different dishes. They're quite versatile and nutritious. And so, yeah, it's really good to just celebrate our farmers today.
Yeah, and I guess you've had an interesting journey as well, haven't you, with your career, in that you're the first in your family to get a university level qualification. Can you tell me a little bit about what it means to go from being the first in your family to get that to now getting this award as well?
Yeah, I was certainly lucky. My parents really valued education, and so I was lucky enough to come to CQU and do my studies there. And I've had a really varied career within education and trade. I've also worked in politics. And so all of those things I feel have brought me to my CEO's role for Egg Farmers of Australia in advocating and helping our egg farmers.
And is there anything that you'd like to tell anyone at home listening who might not have a university level qualification or might never see themselves as a CEO? I guess how you felt at the beginning of your journey, if you ever thought that you would end up in this position?
I think, you know, I'm really a strong advocate for lifelong learning. And I think that, you know, if people have an interest in study, they should look at the avenues to pursue what they're really interested in and passionate about. I have to say that, you know, one of the things with the Churchill fellowships is that, you know, you don't have to have an academic degree. People come from all experiences and backgrounds. And I think that's what makes it so exciting, because people in whatever they do are experts in their own field. And so there's a wide variety of, you know, topics that come through each year. So I would say, being from a rural area, if you're considering, you know, applying for Churchill Fellowship, just do it. We need to have more of our, you know, rural and regional people, you know, being able to go and have these experiences to benefit our community and our country.
Chief Executive of Egg Farmers of Australia, Melinda Hashimoto, speaking there with Claudia Sullivan. It is 14 minutes to one.
It's Jonathan Agnew.
And Alison Mitchell here. The England cricket team's looking sharp, and they're ready to take on the Aussies in the battle for the Ashes.
Grab the ABC Listen app and get ready for the summer of cricket with ABC Sport.
Catch every ball on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
A judgment against an aerial crop spraying company in New South Wales could have implications for all crop spraying businesses, according to the Aerial Application Association of Australia. The crop dusting company is facing a damages bill for $670,000 after a judge found the company had poisoned a cotton crop with the toxic herbicide 2,4-D, as David Claughton reports.
The New South Wales District Court heard that in November 2022, Hardy Irrigation in Collyamberley in the Riverina hired the crop dusting company, which trades as Mass Ag, to spray several cotton fields with the herbicide Weedmaster. 19 days after the spraying, the young cotton plants began showing severe and distinctive signs of poisoning. Judge Robert Newlands, SC, concluded that the crop was affected by the herbicide 2,4-D, which probably came out of the defendant's plane and was not caused by spray drift from neighbouring properties or by Hardy Irrigation themselves. Barrister James Catlin, representing the crop dusting firm, says they are considering an appeal against the judgment.
So the farmers in this case, who mostly did their own spraying, had shocking records as to their own chemical storage possession and use in circumstances where the very poison successfully alleged to have damaged their crops was in their possession and its use was unexplained. Whereas the crop dusters had no 2,4-D, that was the poison, in their possession, and not only kept near perfect records of their possession and use of chemicals, their loading of the herbicide onto the plane, and the herbicide, the purity of it, you could see from its dark blue colour, their loading of it onto the plane was actually videoed.
Judge Robert Newlands was saying that that damage was inconsistent with spray drift. It was highly unlikely the farmer had accidentally poisoned the exact same area themselves. And if it's not from the plane, where's it from?
Well, the farmers did 31 chemical applications of their own. Actually, I think it was 33. The only chemical applications by the crop dusters, they did two. So that's why records are so important. If you're going to assume that it's the crop dusters, you need to lock out the possibility that the farmers have damaged their own crop.
The association representing crop sprayers has warned the decision has broad implications for the sector. Matthew Harper, CEO of the Aerial Application Association of Australia, says he's concerned about a number of issues raised by the decision and it will undermine confidence in the system.
The claim is that 2,4-D was in a chemical batch, or that the aircraft was contaminated, or that it was deliberately added and it was applied across a field, but it didn't show up until 19 days later. If 2,4-D had have been sprayed by that aircraft, you would have expected to see that a day, 2 days later of starting to yellow off.
So you think it would have showed up quicker than the 19 days that I think that the evidence suggests?
If the chemical in question was used, it should have shown up within 48 hours. They should have seen an effect. It does everywhere else in the country, so I don't know why this particular field should be different.
Does the decision have any implications for your sector, for other crop sprayers then, do you think?
This has an implication to every form of spraying or every form of application, be it from the air or be it from ground rigs or be it from farmers applying their own chemicals. If you do not have to use the science to say somebody else has caused a problem, and you can, I guess, cherry pick your science, then there's nothing to stop anyone sort of running into issues that somebody says, hey, you sprayed my crop, you sprayed it 3 weeks ago with an agent that should have killed everything within a day, and now 3 weeks later it's starting to yellow off. And we've also got a really strange application of the Damage from Aircraft Act, which is an act that was designed for when items, you know, legitimately fall off aircraft and cause damage. It wasn't ever intended to be used in a deliberate application case, and losses from deliberate application are much higher on the proof of evidence, which is what we've previously seen other court cases refer to.
Matthew Harper, CEO of the Aerial Application Association of Australia. The growers, Hardy Irrigation, issued a statement through their legal firm saying the relationship between crop dusters and farmer is a very important one in country Australia, especially in times when there is an inability to use ground rigs due to soil and weather conditions. An important aspect of that relationship, they say, is ensuring that the work crop dusters do is done in a careful and safe manner. The decision, the legal company says, has ensured that our client will be compensated for their loss, which was caused by their crops being aerially sprayed by the defendants.
David Claughton with that report. Sophie Johnson with you on the Country Hour. It is 8 minutes to one.
The Scasers had it all.
The story of Australia, the billionaires, the extravagance.
Until they didn't.
They'd gone from the it couple to persona non grata.
Search for ABC Rewind and look for Scase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Have you ever tasted a kumquat or kumquat marmalade? You'll rarely find the tiny citrus that's native to China in the supermarkets. That's one of the reasons why when Rosalyn and Patrick McCarthy readied themselves to leave their careers, a treasured taste of Rosalyn's childhood became their anti-retirement plan.
It's lovely how these flavours can take you back to your grandmother's era, which was such a comforting time, wasn't it?
I love kumquats. They're a beautiful citrus for anybody who hasn't seen them. And you look like you've got a couple of varieties here.
Yes, we've got the Nagami at the front there and then the Kalamondin. The Kalamondins are quite bitter, but they're brilliant for marmalade. And the Nagami, you can eat them whole. They're very, very popular.
And they're just the most gorgeous colour. So where is your farm based?
We're located at Tugulawa, which is near Esk in the Somerset region.
Yeah, we had cattle there, but we've diversified into kumquats, and we also grow ginger for ourselves.
And how on earth did you decide on kumquats?
Oh, I just love kumquats, and you could never buy them. You can't find them anywhere. So I just thought, I'm going to do this, and we planted a kumquat orchard and value add to it.
And how many trees do you have?
Oh, I've got 600.
Okay, so just a few.
Yeah, it's busy.
A lot of fruit. A lot of fruit.
And how old are they now?
Probably about 4 or 5 years. So they're bearing a lot of fruit now, but they're still growing.
We are looking at having a farm shop, and we're continuing to value add by distilling. So very soon we'll move into distilling, and we're looking towards an eau de vie, which in 2 years' time becomes a brandy.
I don't think I've heard of that before.
The eau de vie is the liquid that goes into the barrel, and it sits for 2 years before it can be considered a brandy. So that's our focus or our future direction.
What have you got already?
That's what we call a shrub, which is a very, very old-fashioned drink from the 17th century. And the story behind that is the sailors didn't have refrigeration, so they just put all their excess fruit into an apple cider, being good for their scurvy. The cider would then take on the flavour of the fruit, and then they drink that with their rum. So this is basically a mixer. We do the same process with the fruits that we grow on the farm, and we have it with soda water, but our children will have it with their gin, their vodka, as a mixer.
The word shrub comes from the Arabic word sharab, which means to drink. Ours are based on an apple cider vinegar. My favourite kumquat by far would be the Kalamondin. We have two varieties, the Nagami and the Kalamondin. The Kalamondin is more aromatic. I just love those aromatics.
It looks like a mini mandarin.
It does, yes, it does, but they are sour.
The other one here, is that sweeter?
That's a Nagami, so the skin is sweet. You eat the whole thing like a grape.
Really?
The first bite will be a little bit tangy, and then when you start to eat the skin, it gets sweet.
Well, can we give it a taste test?
Sweet and sour lolly.
High in vitamin C.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah. Oh, I can see a lot of people actually liking that. I've never seen them in the shops.
Yeah, they are growing in demand, definitely. But yeah, it's only a small greengrocers that will stock the kumquats. We sell quite a bit into Rocklea and then also to Sydney, the markets, but next year we'll aim towards Melbourne.
So now I'm trying the kaffir ginger shrub. Oh, yum, that's delicious. Yeah. It's really smart to do a niche product, isn't it?
Yeah.
It seems to be what I do. Things that aren't greatly heard of, you know, like kumquats, like shrub, and now an eau de vie.
Is this a career change for you?
Yeah, definitely a career change. But we've had the farm for about 18 years, and we just had cattle. So we've diversified from cattle into more than just one produce. It secures the future or the viability of the farm, really.
And it's of an interest to us. We're both sort of I've retired from my profession, and Roz has as well, so I love doing what we do.
What was your previous profession?
I was a science teacher, and Pat was an accountant.
An accountant. Yes. Okay, well, you know, those number skills will come in handy for your small business.
Oh, we love it. It's great.
We've just recently completed a commercial kitchen on the property, so a very large shed, 14 by 9 metres, and a very large kitchen in there so we can start to increase capacity.
So you're growing a little bit of ginger too?
We'd have about a quarter of an acre of ginger every year, and we use those a lot in our products.
That's our candied ginger. We process that probably over about a 3-day period and then cook it in its own syrup, cold press quite a lot of ginger, and then that's the end product. It's got a fair bit of bite to it because it's fresh. But
you try one of those?
Absolutely.
That's yummy.
Some of our product does go to the Journey Beyond Rail, which is served on the Great Southern Train Journey and the Indian Pacific. The relish is a new one, and we trialled it quite a lot before we decided to proceed with that.
Oh, that sounds tough, not?
It is lovely. Very, very nice.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful with any of your meats, really. And I did a brisket and just coated the brisket in the relish, placed the fruit in a crevice, and then slow cooked it for 10 to 12 hours. It was just divine. Like, the outside was tangy, and then you got that sweet skin, and it just came together well.
Oh, that sounds like you're having a tremendous time.
You certainly have to have purpose and need to keep busy, and it's our time schedule, you know. It's very pleasing.
It's lovely. We're enjoying it.
Pat and Rosalind McCarthy from Kumquats Australia speaking to Jennifer Nichols. And you can see what those kumquats look like in this story on the ABC Rural website. Just search ABC Rural Kumquats and that story from Jen should be up. And that's all we have time for on the Country Hour this afternoon. I'm Sophie Johnson, and it has been an absolute pleasure to be with you on the program. A reminder about those fire bans that are in place for those 12 council areas across parts of northern and central Queensland today. And if you feel like listening back to today's program, you can find it on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Queensland Country Hour to find all of our programs and feature stories right there in one place. Coming up to news time now, 1 o'clock. I'll be back with you again tomorrow from midday. Until then, hooroo.